Chapter 2. St. Thomas's Hospital. John hears the explosion, but it is distant, ill-defined, and he is unaware of the enormity of what has occurred. Right now he is focused on the single life he is determined to save. He has forgotten the dinner he was hoping to eat, the drink that was waiting for him in his single room. He's not even sure why saving the wounded man means so much to him. A memory of some battlefield ethic? Leave no one behind? It has been a long time since he has acted in this way, but it makes him feel good. It reminds him of himself. The entrance hall of the St. Thomas's Hospital is large and high-ceilinged, lit by hanging lanterns with thick glass shades whose wavering greenish light always makes him feel as if he is entering an underwater cavern. Along the walls are ranks of wooden chairs which would usually be occupied by patients waiting to be seen, but at this late hour there are only one or two huddled figures, half asleep. The rest are empty. The night receptionist has already taken over and sits behind a wooden desk writing in a ledger scattered with biscuit crumbs. On the wall above her, in foot-high letters made up of dark blue mosaic tiles, are the words, "The greatest wealth is health." He approaches the desk, and the woman looks up. "Yes." The single word could mean almost anything. It seems to suggest, why are you bringing a sick man here? What do you think this is, a hospital? "I found this man by the river," John explains. He remembers the woman's name. "It's Dawn." "Can we get someone to look at him?" Dawn cranes her neck to see the occupant of the trolley. "Are you sure? He looks past helping to me." Is she a nurse? A doctor? Does she know anything? John swallows his annoyance. "Can you just make the call, please?" With a sigh, she reaches for the telephone and taps in a number. The line is connected, and John hears a recorded voice apologising for the wait, and then the tinny sound of music at the other end. It's quite something when even the receptionist is put on hold. He could be here for a while. But then, from the other side of the reception area, he hears the grinding of metal as a lift arrives. The doors open, and a man emerges dressed in a white coat. John has known George Adalgi since they took their final year exams together, although at the time the young doctor was several places below him. Now he is a consultant, and it was George who got John the porter's job on his return from the front. Something has happened. Dr. Adalgi looks flustered, his eyes blinking behind his thick spectacles. That doesn't prevent John crossing his path.
"Not now, John,"
George says, formal for once, pulling rank. John gestures to the limp body on the bed. This man was lying on the Thames path. He's got a depressed skull fracture, possibly some cerebral swelling. He needs... He checks himself. Well, you know what he needs. George Adalgi sighs. He wants to be on his way, but he knows that he has to go through the motions. Walking over to the trolley, he turns the pale head and examines the wound. He shakes his head.
"I know it looks bad," John breaks in before the other man can speak, "but I've seen men with injuries like this pull through."
"I'm sorry, John. Operating would be a waste of time. And anyway, right now there's no one here with the training to cope with the trauma of that severity."
"Yes, there is,"
John wants to scream.
"Me!"
But he can't, not without humiliating George in front of the receptionist and the waiting patients. He lowers his voice so the people on the chairs don't hear.
"We're not too busy tonight. Couldn't you just give it a go? Or maybe one of the nurses?"
"Forget it, John." Adalgi's tone hardens. "I've just heard there's been an incident in Richmond, a major incident. There's a plane come down."
"A plane? How is that even possible?"
Adalgi glances at his watch.
"We haven't heard anything yet, but in half an hour this place could be mayhem. In fact, we could use you if you don't mind working through the night. God knows what's heading our way."
The doctor takes one last glance at the unconscious man.
"The ambulances are already on the way. Just take this man to the waiting room."
The waiting room. They both know what that means. The hospital is overcrowded and under-resourced. There aren't enough supplies to waste on those who don't have much chance. The waiting room is where you go to die, quietly, preferably, unless they have run out of palliative drugs.
John opens his mouth to argue, but then reminds himself that there's no point.
Of course.
I'll take him down there now. He wheels the trolley into the elevator that the doctor has just vacated and presses the button for B, waiting room and mortuary. As they begin the slow journey down into the basement, John leans against the wall. Dalgy is probably right, and the man has no chance.
But still, they could have tried.
He is worn out, exhausted and ashamed of himself. He gave up too easily. Surely he could have made a better case for his patient, at least tried to fight. The twist of guilt in the pit of his stomach is a familiar feeling. All soldiers have it. The ones who live. After a prolonged shuddering and grinding, the lift jerks to a halt. John has pulled the gates halfway open when he freezes. From the corner of his eye, he is sure he saw the man move. He stares down at the marble features, but they are completely still. It must have been the jolting of the lift. He wheels the bed out and down a dimly lit corridor painted a dark red. Pipes and wires snake along the low ceiling, like the arteries and veins of the building. There are just two doors on this floor, and he makes for the first, the squeaking of the trolley wheels loud in the hush. A blank-faced nurse sits at a desk just inside the door. The desk is turned towards the room, but she has angled her chair away from the shadowy ranks of beds arranged against the walls. The air is sour with illness and chemicals.
Sorry, John says. I've got another one for you. But it's never as easy as that.
Even down here, quite literally at death's door, there are formalities. Paperwork.
Fill this in.
The nurse hands him a form and a pen. I'm afraid I can't help you, John says, looking down at the various empty boxes waiting to be filled in. Name, address, and next of kin. I don't know any of his details. He was attacked and they stripped him of everything. He remembers the nightmare figures he met beside the river. Kids, he adds. They were only in their teens. She sighs, uninterested in the tale.
We still need the paperwork for our records. I'll get into trouble otherwise.
She opens a drawer and takes out a slim ledger.
If it's identity unknown, you'll just have to make something up. Can have a first name from the book.
She gives John the ledger.
We're on S this month. Crossed out ones have been used already, and it makes life easier if you don't use the same one twice. For surnames, just pick a colour or an animal.
Before she can say any more, there's a pitiful whimper from behind a screen. She gets up and disappears from sight. John sighs. He has no time for this. Will he really have to stay behind and help with the injured coming in from Richmond? He's already worked a 9-hour day and the whiskey is calling to him. Reluctantly, he takes a seat and opens the dog-eared volume. It's a book of boys' names. Most of them are crossed out and the remaining ones are outlandish. In A, there's only Ethelred and Auburn. He flicks through the pages. E suggests Edwidge and Elined. M offers Moxie and Mandrake. S begins a few pages on. Salmon has been crossed out. And Salim, and Sebastian, and Sean. He fills in the form with the first unattached name that catches his eye, and picks the first animal that comes to mind. The name is ridiculous, but nobody will ever look at it, not on a death certificate. The box below asks for a date of birth, so he'll have to take a guess. He looks down at the prone figure. A few years younger than him, he thinks. Mid to late 20s? That would make him born... when? He calculates in his head and reaches out with the pen when a hand closes on his wrist. The man's eyes are open and fixed on him. John stares back. He has never known a patient in the waiting room to wake up. Maybe these are just the reflex responses of a dying brain, and yet there is a certain alertness in the pale grey gaze. Hello, he says softly, as if the other people in the room are only asleep. I'm John. You're in hospital. The man blinks and his tongue emerges to moisten his dry lips. Is he trying to speak? Can you tell me your name? John asks, hardly believing this is happening. The man's lips move and John leans closer. He says something, but John is not sure he catches it. Holmes? He repeats the word he thought he heard. Your surname is Holmes?
But the eyelids are fluttering down now, and a moment later the pale man slips back into unconsciousness. On the form, John crosses out the animal he had chosen and writes, Holmes. He can hear the nurse behind the screen, trying to calm down whatever poor doomed soul is lying there. She'll be back soon, ready to process the new arrival. As far as she's concerned, Holmes is dead already, only moments after his christening. John thinks about the occupants of the waiting room. They rarely wake up. They don't speak. They never grip your arm with enough strength to leave a mark. He makes a decision. Crumpling the form into his pocket, John kicks the brake off the bed and wheels it quickly away. The operating theatres at the St. Thomas's Hospital are located on the fourth floor. There are 9 of them, although there is never enough equipment or medication for more than 3 to be used at the same time. God knows what they will do if the emergency at Richmond brings in too many victims. John briefly considers the chances of a plane crash. Planes do occasionally pass over London on their way to the coast, but the city's airports have long since been decommissioned, and no Londoner could afford the extortionate fares anyway. Only the very rich and the very important fly these days, and they would never put their lives at risk with a plane that hadn't been meticulously serviced, which makes the chances of a crash in London very small indeed. He sighs. How could the 21st century ever have come to this? Of course, there had been worries, a sense that the world was turning in on itself, that mechanisms that had worked for centuries were suddenly no longer fit for purpose. For millions of people, life had turned into a daily dogfight. Food banks had suddenly appeared, and equally suddenly had become so commonplace that nobody even commented anymore. Politicians had not just failed. In England and all over the world, they had given up on reality, fighting for popularity and votes with ever more ruinous programs that had led only to greater poverty, civil unrest, strikes, and eventually, anarchy. And then there were all the well-meaning experts with their warnings. Global warming, pandemics, economic collapse, war. But the people had decided they'd had enough of experts and preferred to drift blindly to their fate. Which was why nobody had noticed the shift in their way of life. In London, there had been a two-way migration. The wealthy left. The poor not only stayed behind, but were joined by millions more. And gradually, imperceptibly, they had become used to a way of life that was more reminiscent of Charles Dickens than the 21st century. When the electricity supply faltered, the gas lamps flickered back on. With the price of petrol out of anyone's reach, horses were suddenly the easiest way of transport. And why not? Even at the height of London's financial success, it had been said that the average speed in the streets was only 4 miles per hour. The food banks not only stayed, they became ubiquitous. The homeless almost outnumbered the homed, and most of them gave up begging when they realized there was nobody left to give. Public services largely became a memory. Every day was a new struggle. And yet, life went on. It's one of the most remarkable aspects of humanity that people will accept the situation in which they find themselves and somehow make do. There were still pubs, clubs, restaurants, theatre performances, families, schools, holidays in the Lake District, buses, taxis and traffic jams. It was just that everything had become a little bit more difficult. A little bit more Victorian. A visitor from the start of the millennium would still recognise London. They just wouldn't want to live there. John considers all this as the lift makes its tortuous progress to the fourth floor, and with a jolt that would rattle the bones of any patient awaiting surgery, comes to a halt. He pushes the trolley out and is relieved to see the duty nurse sitting at her small desk reading a paperback. For once, he's in luck. It's Nurse Hudson. The two of them are friends. They don't socialise outside the hospital, but they often eat together in the ground floor cafe and know about each other's lives. John has learnt that her first name is Missy, that she was recently widowed from a man who both loved her and then left her for another woman, that she has no children, and that she has worked at the hospital for around 5 years. John feels comfortable in her presence. She's an attractive, self-assured, Afro-Caribbean woman in her early 30s, with bright eyes and a warm smile. She's never afraid to speak her mind,
She knows her life is full of holes, but she is determined to enjoy it anyway.
John?
She's surprised to see him this late at night. John knows that he has to make an instant decision. Is he going to lie to her, or can he draw her in to help? He knows that what he is planning could be the end of his tenure at the hospital. Does he have any right to implicate her too? But Missy is already examining the unconscious man on the stretcher. Almost instinctively, she has taken his pulse and measures the beat against the watch that she wears on her chest.
Was this the man you brought in with Ollie Lestrade?
Is that the boy with anemia? You know him. Was he okay?
The transfusion saved him. You were right to make that call. It might have been a lot worse if he'd waited any longer. The mother wasn't too pleased, though. She was complaining about you. Now who is this?
I don't know. He had no papers, nothing. All I know is that he has a serious head injury. He needs surgery.
OT6 is prepped? Who's doing the op?
Actually, there are no doctors available. She looks puzzled.
So why have you brought him here?
Slowly, understanding creeps into her eyes.
Where's his PFS?
Permission for surgery. It's the form attached to every patient who's brought here. John has made his decision.
We don't have a lot of time, he says. There's been a major incident in Richmond, and according to Dawn on reception, the whole hospital is going to be insane. I found this man by the river, and I don't know. I thought if I could just have half an hour in an operating room, I could fix him up myself. I know it looks bad, he continues hurriedly, but it's a simple enough operation, actually. When I was in the army, I saw plenty of injuries like that. You just take the fragments out and fix them together and then put everything back in place and sew him up.
Missy Hudson stares at him.
Why?
She asks. The single word asks many questions.
I just told you, I found him. That makes him my responsibility.
John remembers the moment outside the waiting room, when Holmes briefly woke up.
And there's something different about him. I can't really explain it to you, Missy. I found him, and I brought him here, and now I want to save him. And I know I shouldn't be asking this, but I can't do it alone.
There's a pause. Then Nurse Hudson sighs.
This is against every rule. You realize I could lose my job.
I know. I'm sorry. She takes a breath. Then somehow, she manages a thin smile.
Why did it have to be me?
I'm glad it was. I'm sure. I'll take full responsibility.
All right.
She lowers the patient's hand and rests it on his chest. Suddenly, she's all business.
His pulse is fine, but let me take a look at him. I want to know I'm not wasting my time.
Gently, she strokes the hair away and examines the gaping wound, wincing.
You really think you can do this?
John half smiles. What's the worst that could happen?
We could kill him. What's happened at Richmond?
An aeroplane has come down.
A plane?
That's what they say. Missy Hudson sighs.
And I thought it was going to be a quiet night.
The two of them take the trolley together, wheeling it down the silent corridor. They pass a window, and John notices the empty streets. No sign of any ambulances yet. They come to a door marked OT6.
In here.
As she pushes the door open, she glances left and right down the corridor, making sure they're not seen. Wheeling the bed into the operating theater, John positions it under the lamps, locks the brake, and turns up the gas. The light brightens, glimmering off the nurse's dark curls as she dons a gown and gloves. Hanging up his coat, John puts on his own gown, while Missy gathers the instruments they'll need from the drawers and cupboards. Scalpel, retractors, drill, saw, tray, plates and screws, gauze and suture materials, loading them onto the surgical trolley. Collecting disinfectant, a cutthroat razor and cotton wool, she goes back to their patient and sets about cleaning and shaving the area around the wound. Strands of his brown hair drift onto the pitted wooden floor. After washing and disinfecting his hands, John returns to the bed, and the two of them meet over the unconscious man.
Ready?
John asks. Nurse Hudson hands him the scalpel. The instrument trembles in John's hand, throwing dancing light up the wall. It's been 2 years since he performed an operation like this,
and the last time was in a makeshift tent surrounded by shouting and distant explosions. The chaos of the battlefield somehow made it easier. Life was cheap. There was never any blame when a patient died.
"You need to cut about here,"
Missy says, tracing a line across the man's scalp with her fingernail.
"I know. Then you better get started."
John breathes deeply in and out, then lowers the tip of the blade. Once he begins, years of training and experience take over. The scalpel, the drill, the saw. It's called a surgical procedure for a reason. Everything has to be done by the book. The two of them work together in silence, but they have found the strange telepathy of the operating theatre, where each of them knows and understands the other's needs and performs their tasks without the need for speech. John has never been closer to Missy, although this was not the sort of intimacy he had ever imagined. It's not brain surgery exactly. As far as John can see, the brain itself is undamaged, although there are fragments of loose bone that have to be removed. It's more a task of reconstruction, reassembling the skull, fixing everything together with plates and screws. But it's still a slow, painstaking process, and one that demands total concentration. John finds himself sweating under the lights, and occasionally, without his needing to ask, Nurse Hudson mops his brow. It's a strangely intimate moment, which, despite everything, he enjoys. Once the neat line of black stitches is complete, he steps away from the table to let her swab the area with antiseptic and apply the bandages. Stripping off his gown and gloves, he takes them over to the laundry bins, then he leans against the wall and exhales for what feels like the first time since the surgery began. A glance at his watch reveals that it has taken almost 90 minutes. Not bad, considering how rusty he must be. He goes back to check his patient's vital signs. Blood pressure and temperature are, miraculously, normal.
"Do you think it worked?"
she asks. "We'll have to see. There's always a risk of infection, and you're going to have to look out for post-traumatic epilepsy.
So we'll need to find him a bed here."
It's an unpleasant thought, and one that only occurs to John now.
"I suppose we'll have to. He's certainly not going anywhere anytime soon."
"Don't sound so glum about it. You saved his life."
She breaks into a broad smile, and then, before he can react, she is hugging him. The sensation of being in the arms of another human being is so unexpected, so alien, that for a moment he can only stand there, blinking stupidly. Her body is soft and warm against his, her chest rising and falling with his as she breathes. Tentatively, he raises his arms and folds them around her back and feels her soft curls against his face. Over her shoulder, he can see their entwined shadow on the tiled wall opposite. The low lamps make him look taller. Missy freezes. He pulls away quickly. Has he done something wrong? But she isn't looking at him. She's looking down at the bed. He turns. The patient's eyes are open. John swears under his breath. It's bilateral ptosis, otherwise known as the death stare. Dr. Adalji was right. He should never have wasted resources and missed his time on the operation. He has put both their jobs at risk for nothing. The eyes blink. "Hello?" Missy says gently, crouching beside the bed.
"Hello,"
the man says in a cracked voice. John's heart sets up a painful banging against his ribcage.
"You're in hospital," Missy says. "You had quite a severe injury to your head.
The doctors just fixed you up. How are you feeling?" There is a moment's pause, and then the man speaks in a cracked but clear and perfectly audible voice.
"I'm a little thirsty."
John hurries over to the sink and fills a porcelain cup with water. When he returns, the man is struggling to sit. Missy holds him while John moves the cup to his lips. As Mr. Holmes raises his hand to guide it, John and Missy exchange glances of astonishment. This degree of alertness and motor function this soon after major cranial surgery?
"Another, please."
John fetches it,
Then they lower him back down onto the pillows.
How are you feeling?
John asks.
I have a headache.
Mr. Holmes closes his eyes, and seconds later he is peacefully asleep. Missy and John stare at each other over the prostrate form.
I've never seen anything like that, Missy breathes. He wasn't just conscious, he was totally coherent. I'm a little thirsty. I just strolled into the pub.
I told you he was different. Missy gazes down at the pale face, now still and serene.
What do you think happened to him?
I suppose we'll find out when he wakes up again. She nods.
Look, I'll find him a bed somehow. We can talk to him tomorrow. You ought to go home and get some rest.
What about you?
Night shifts this week. Lucky me.
John smiles at her, thinking of their embrace, the warmth of her touch.
Thank you, he says.
I couldn't have done it without you.
No, she grins. You couldn't. Now I need to clear up in here, so out of my way.
He leaves her, trudging back to the entrance hall. The operation has taken a lot out of him, mentally and physically, but he can't go home yet. He must stay to help with the arrivals from Richmond. But when he gets there, the entrance hall is almost deserted. There are no ambulance drivers or stretcher bearers in sight, no walking wounded. He goes over to the receptionist who greeted him when he arrived.
What's happened?
He asks.
What do you mean?
Dawn seems to have forgotten their earlier conversation.
The plane crash. Oh, you can forget about that. They're all dead. The whole lot of them, more than 300 of them from what I hear. They've taken the bodies over to Barnes Hospital. There's nothing for us to do. How can she be so matter of fact?
John looks at the round, empty face. She's already returned to the puzzle magazine on the desk in front of her. There's nothing more to be said. And John has no need to be here after all. He pads softly across the room and steps out into the night. A southerly breeze blows across the river, bringing with it the homely smells of coal fires and pipe smoke. John stops and takes a deep breath, frowning as he detects something else in the air, acrid and unpleasant. It takes him a few moments to recognize it for what it is. Aviation fuel. He walks back across Westminster Bridge, moving in and out of the glow from the street lamps. When he gets to the middle, he pauses and leans over the balustrade. For the first time, he asks himself what exactly happened tonight. The unconscious man had been stripped and robbed of everything by the gang of feral children. But were they responsible for the wound to his skull? Certainly they were armed, but it seems unlikely. More likely the man fell. Drunk, perhaps. It was the sort of blunt trauma you would expect from a car accident, a sudden and almost lethal contact with a hard surface such as a road. And he was soaking wet, too. Had he climbed out of the river? Had the children pulled him out? Where had he come from? Wherever it was, he has brought with him a pile of unanswered questions. 30 minutes later, he arrives at the front door of his Pimlico lodgings. For once, he does not have to pause to catch his breath halfway up the stairs to the attic room. Despite the lateness of the hour and the exhausting events of the evening, he finds he's wide awake. The narrow staircase does not seem as oppressive as usual, and when he opens the door, the single room is awash with moonlight. The cloud cover has blown away, and a fine crescent moon is visible through the tiny gable window. The strand of silver makes him think of the knife he wielded in the operating theatre.
Did he really do that?
Yes, he did.
And he succeeded.
Is that the reason the stairs were not so arduous tonight, the room less Spartan? Why his mind wasn't preoccupied with whiskey all the way here? Yes. For the first time in a year, he feels like himself again. He is a doctor, not a porter. Tonight proved that. He will have a drink. Not to anesthetize himself, but to celebrate. Taking the bottle and glass from the cupboard, he pours himself a scotch and goes over to the window, looking out over the view of the city. When he rented this room, he was sorry that he would not have a river view, but tonight the rooftops are beautiful. Smoke drifts like gossamer between the chimneys, and even at this hour, a few of the attic windows are aglow. He sees a single horse and carriage rattle past and wonders what journey the driver is making at this time of night. The crescent moon is still there in the sky, not hidden by clouds. Standing by the window, he feels something that he hasn't felt for a long time, and it hasn't been provoked by the whiskey. Just for a moment, he is completely at peace. He raises his glass in a toast to the strange, pale invalid whose life he saved. "Sherlock Holmes," John murmurs. Slightly better than Sherlock Camel, his original choice, but not much. He'll find out the man's real name tomorrow.